We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today are two guests, Tom Luongo and Vince Lancey. Tom is the producer of the Gold Goats and Guns newsletter and blog, editor at Newsmax and Ultimate Wealth Report, and a contributor to the Financial Intelligence Report. Vince is a professor of MBA finance and also the publisher of the Gold Fix Substack. Thanks for joining me today, guys.
Thanks, Tom. As always, it's lovely to see you.
What he said.
This is a conversation that in some ways started, you know, actually a long time ago. We had a bit of a four-way panel around the Basel III, the new regulations that were coming in, and everybody's speculation about how that was going to change the gold price overnight and all of these things. So this has been a bit of an evolving conversation, and I'm grateful to be able to host both of you for it. So I was thinking maybe we could kind of start by tying a couple loose ends up from a couple of your guys' previous conversations here. You know, one thing that I think that is really important to understand, and I've gotten emails about from some of my listeners, is wondering, you know, how the world ends up working together. If China holds, you know, billions of dollars of US treasuries, when they go to dump that, or if they want to sell that overnight, you know, that doesn't intrinsically make sense to me, because that creates not only, you know, floods the market, which would theoretically crash the value, and create a whole lot more tension within the world. So maybe we could kind of start there. And I think that gives us a good jumping off point.
Go ahead, Vince.
I think just focusing on the China treasury dumping concept as a proxy for all that ails us, or as an extreme solution to all that they feel ails them. If they were to do that, they would be cutting off their nose to spite their face. Now, cliche aside, you know, because they have the portfolio, cliche aside, there is one thing that China and the US have in common, although they're going in opposite directions, and that is they're both capitalists. Don't tell me China's communist. It's an authoritarian capitalist society, right? So the idea in that type of society is to make money, whether you're woke capitalist or I guess it's Marxist capitalist. China wants to make money, so they're not going to dump their bonds. And if you look at this very quickly, you know, the East hates the West's financial supply chain, if you want to call it that, right? And as much as they may want to dump the treasuries, they won't. For the same reason they didn't just dump them 20 years ago. They're seeking a slow changeover replacement to preserve their newly born capitalist economy. Therefore, everything, and you know, this is a very Tom Luongo thing, this is everything is cui bono. Mm-hmm. Everything is a negotiation. And so, as we were talking before we started recording, the cooler heads have China's like, we're just make a trip to us and let's talk. And I guess I'm leaving that open for Tom Luongo, you know, like, and sure. the trips were made.
Right? Well, I agree with you, Vince. I mean, you know, I've never thought the idea that China would just, well, one day wake up and dump all their treasury bonds on the market would be the dumbest thing imaginable. I mean, that's literally like declaring World War III. And if there's one thing that I think is clear at this point, is that the Chinese don't want a war with us anymore than really we want a war with them. We have state actors. We have people like Victoria Nuland and Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken and whatnot. We have these neocons that want this. But that expresses only one aspect of the U.S. political and financial system. And I think that once when you look at recent history, as we were talking before, you've got Jerome Powell and Jamie Dimon both go over to China. You know, Dimon meets with members of the Politburo, for Christ's sake, right? And then you have that happen. And then what you see coming back after that is a it's all of a series of move counter move, right? So after that, we start to hear a lot of stuff coming out about Joe Biden. Now let's talk about the current treason that's on the table for Joe Biden that everybody is trying to sweep under the rug. The guy took $10 million in bribes through his son. They've got the smoke. China's got the smoking gun on him. Even if it didn't happen, the narrative's out there. It's like, if you don't think that the PBOC can't produce bank records to prove that Joe Biden took $10 million in bribes. So now they own it. And why would they own him at this point? Now, the classic China hawk neocons will go, Gozi works for China and he's trying to sell the United States out. No, they own him to stop him from going any farther. Okay. So Biden is, the way I was writing it up this morning for my people, is this. Biden at this point is like John McCain in the year before, his brain tumor gave its life for our country. He was owned by so many people. Right? I know. I regret that as John McCain's brain tumor, I regret I only have one life to give for my country. He's owned by so many different factions. He doesn't know when he wakes up in the morning who he's going to have to answer to. Biden owes his position as presidency to Davos. He owes, he's owned by China because of all the money. He's owned by oligarchs in Ukraine, yada, yada, yada. You could construct any narrative around why Joe Biden wants a war in Ukraine or a war with China or doesn't want a war with China that you want to make.
And then he ends up answering to the burner phone.
And that's a really interesting moment.
I'm not even caught up on that.
This is actually the jumping off point for this morning's post that I just put out for my patrons before we get on the call, which is the burner phone thing two things. One, how does somebody get the number to the burner phone? Who gave that number to somebody who would then be able to then make that call and that event public? Like, these are all questions about why we know what we think we know about Joe Biden answering the burner phone. Like, someone is clearly trying to stop World War III, is the way I read that, as to Vince's point. Cooler heads are prevailing. But the problem is that there's still a bunch of hotheads running around trying to get us into World War III. And this is the move, counter move. And I know we're kind of off where we wanted to go with this because I know, but this is important to understand as a backdrop to all the things that we're seeing, I think, across almost every vertical or idiom within geopolitics at this point, is that someone is trying to take down Joe Biden. Someone is trying to keep Joe Biden around just long enough to start World War III. Other people are responding in such a way to do backdoor end runs around the Pentagon not wanting to be involved in World War III. And I could go into Poland and all the rest of it. I see what's going on with the Poles and the Germans and everything else. When you start going down that rabbit hole, when you start like seeing it that way, it's really obvious that there's factions trying to push us into a conflict because they are about to lose everything else if they don't ratchet up the conflict in Ukraine. And now we set the stage for what we're starting to see in other aspects of this, because I know that there's something going on here within the European finance, right? With the central banks and with the ECB and all of these things, that's out there. And I was trying to make sense of where I thought this conversation was going to go this morning by brain dumping onto my patrons. And I hope that, I'm going to find out what Vince has to say about this. I think this is very important.
A nice lead in. The geopolitical angle, it's funny because I'm going to approach what you just said from a market-based geopolitical angle.
Right.
Going back to, so one of the things you said that kind of framed everything was you can sense there's a change in behavior. Now there's pushback as well, but starting at the last thing you said, Biden may be, options are being presented that if Biden doesn't do what needs to be done, they'll be exercised, whether it be by China or all the other people that have their hands in his pockets or his hands in their pockets, however you look at it. But the geopolitical, the cooler heads are emerging. We're not sure if they're prevailing yet because of the pushback, as you alluded to. But the current events, which is what you focused on, it's interesting because I was surprised at how quickly it's morphed compared to historical geopolitics. But here's why I'm saying that. About 6 months ago, I was having a conversation with Bryn Kelly. He's an oil person, and historically, I'm an oil trader as well. And we were talking about oil's going up, oil's going down. It started with bullish bearish oil, right? And it's like, oh, the SPR is being drained, and eventually they're going to have a comeuppance, and oil's going to spike. And that may be true depending on your time frame. But what I had noticed, and what Bryn and I were talking about that connected, was, you know, for the last year, every time OPEC said something mean, they did something mean. Every time Biden said something mean, he did something mean. Maybe not to OPEC, but he'd be like, okay, we're anti-oil. And he would, you know, throw a tariff at oil companies. And OPEC would say, we're cutting back on production. You know, the West is manipulating oil prices. And they were. And they would cut back. And then you know, it's not subtle if you're familiar with it, if you've been scarred by the geopolitics of oil. But in the last 6 months, I noticed a couple things. And this is leading into the Biden situation now. He softened on OPEC. OPEC softened on him, and the public rhetoric toned down. Now, it's going to ramp up and go back and forth. But you started hearing things like first of all, and this is all part of my conspiracy theory stuff or my trading stuff. Goldman stopped talking super cycle, which is, you know, they stopped talking their book, which means they're no longer long. That's my opinion, right? The second thing is OPEC started talking about production cuts, and Biden's response was, paraphrasing, or Biden's, whoever's operating the Biden sock puppet, made a comment like they're going to do what they're going to do, or, you know, we're not involved in that. I'm like, what do you mean you're not involved in that? You were pushing back, you know, with the whole fire breathing thing a year ago. And then I also noticed that big oil stopped being attacked. And on top of that, Exxon gets rights to drill for lithium. And they start talking. It's not the progressives aren't really allowed to see this yet, but the loosening up of oil, domestic oil, which is all part of the whole reshoring program, starts to happen. And I say, oh, there's a change geopolitically. And the geopolitical change is, we've been beating the shit out of each other for a year now. Let's chill out, because we're kind of in jeopardy, you know, as the elites of our tribes. And that's my projection, obviously. But from there, I said, okay, so there's a truce for now between them and us, however you want to categorize that. What's going to happen domestically? And the geopolitical manifestation domestically is Biden's weaker. I watched oil. The point is, I was like, oil's going down. I don't care. You know, they're going to say they're going to buy oil. It's going to go down. The Saudis are going to say they're going to cut production. Anyway, the point is, like Biden's not weaker, is not the right word, although it is correct. As peace is made, at least temporarily, with the East, call it the Saudis, Biden's less needed as a lightning rod. So his work is done, so to speak. And so domestically, I was like, okay, let's see how big business reacts. And sure enough, Powell, the oil guys start coming out saying not negative things about Biden, and Powell makes a trip there. And that's where I kind of lost my feel for it, which is where Tom picked up the thread. And that is, there seems to be, bringing it back to markets and geopolitics and de-dollarization, or just putting a big frame around that, there is a growing acceptance in the West that we are easing off the dollar to the point of we're not dumping bonds, as China was saying. And there's a growing acceptance, I believe, in the East that if they get what they want in this long, slow negotiation, they'll stop being assholes. That's my opinion on everything. So hopefully, yeah, makes sense.
Okay. Do you have a...
I have something as a counterpoint to that, Vince, and it's something that you actually brought up recently on your Twitter feed, and that's the word mercantilism.
I was wrong. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, okay. But how does that fit in, right? Like, explain your point about the fact that the mainstream media doesn't, or nobody seems to want to use the word mercantilism.
Yeah.
And how does that, you know, in a lot of ways, redistribute power, capital, gold, any of that?
Yeah, everything that we're talking about, the personality interaction, the geopolitical behavior that Tom is talking about, and about how trade is breaking down, whether it be across continents, it's all a manifestation of, and here's the word that they're using, they won't use mercantilism, it's all a manifestation of deglobalization. So you hear the words, the supply chains need to be rebuilt. We need to, the U.S., we need to reshore, we need to rearm, we need to do an energy transition, become less dependent on foreign oil. All that is policy. And that policy is the result of the deglobalization, the little complexity collapse. There's a book by Tainter that I think at least a couple of us have read here. And he's an archaeologist, but he talks about how empires collapse. Now, I'm not saying that we're collapsing, but complexity collapses or shrinks. So it kind of shrinks in these countries, all of us, because of COVID, revealing how fragile the supply chains are, and kind of revealing to the West, like, oh, shit, we really do need their stuff over there. And they're like, oh, shit, they really do need our stuff over there. And so it's a renegotiation, union versus management type of thing. Mm-hmm. So this all happens, and what you end up getting is you end up getting the need to, how do I say this? The complexity collapses, and what replaces globalism is mercantilism. What is mercantilism? Mercantilism is an old school word that describes how the world came out of feudalism on the way to pure capitalism. And mercantilism was capitalism, but gold is money, right? And that's what they say. But the point I think TB wants me to bring up, and I think it's the most important point, is just cutting to the chase, is that mercantilism is what was the predecessor to World War I and World War II. And because of it, for right or wrong reason, If you're a mercantile nation, you're colonizing. You're colonizing for gold, and it's a dethroning of fiat. It's an admission that humanity isn't really innovative anymore. And so, what we've done is we've fallen back from globalism to mercantilism. I don't trust you, Tom. You're Canadian. I don't trust you, Tom Luongo. You're from Florida for sure, right? And I'm from New York. So I'm not going to use Florida dollars or you know, Ottawa dollars. I'm going to use, but we still want to do business. I kind of like your cigars, Tom, you know, and I kind of like the Macintosh candies. I love those, you know? So
and we have good whiskey now down here in Florida now too, by the way.
Of course, of course. And I'm sure you've had some tequila and rum as well.
I'm much more happy that there's a burgeoning whiskey industry here in Florida.
Of course. But we need to keep trading, because if we don't keep trading, if I don't get my cigars or my Pete's coffee, if I don't get those things, we're going to go to war, right? So that's gold. And so while Europe is like, mercantilism is bad, they don't even mention it, right? Because it brings up it's the gold aspect. Of the gold is bridging the divide that continues, that keeps trade going on, that allows us to go to our neutral corners and hopefully heal. And over time, we can kind of reglobalize. I don't know. I mean, that's, I don't know.
So my understanding of mercantilism is an economic thing. And this is part of, I think, what you're talking about here, is that remember that ultimately mercantilism, the colonization aspect of mercantilism, is that you put high protection tariffs on your own, on your domestic production, to protect your domestic production while you weaken the currency.
Right.
Right. This is a classic mercantilism as geopolitical action. So what are we doing? We've been, during COVID, now with the war with Russia, who's clearly pushing towards some form of gold-backed trade settlement east of the international north-south transport corridor, that we're going to put high protection tariffs on them, and we're going to regionalize the global trade, and we're going to use only gold as a means by which to settle trade across that what is, in my mind, becoming the new Iron Curtain.
Right. Right? No, that's exactly.
So, yeah. Okay. So now, with that said, the Chinese understand that, you know, again, I agree with you completely, Ben, that the United States still needs China stuff. Europe still needs China stuff. But they still need our consumers, and they still need our innovation base and all the rest of it. You know, the death of the United States as a vibrant economy is greatly overstated. The death of the dollar is greatly overstated. I've been screaming about this for freaking months now, and it's like, it's so obvious that the people who are pushing de-dollarization are the ones who want the end of the dollar, and those people are not. It's not as much coming from the Russians and the Chinese as much as they want the end of dollar diplomacy and dollar hegemony. The people who want the end of the dollar are in Europe, because they need to have their currency, their euro, be the model. And this is very clear to me. The East wants to de-dollarize because they understand that the dollar has been weaponized through mercantile action, starting with President Trump. And it's really sort of with Obama putting sanctions on Russia for taking Crimea. The right. whole purpose of Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Act and everything else was to take sanctions policy beyond the scope of the scope of only being able to sanction nations. Now they can sanction individuals. Now they can sanction corporations. Now they can do all the things that they're currently doing. So now let's take it back. Now let's talk about what happened last weekend with Prigozhin Day, or whatever you want to call it. And at the same time, there's this meeting in Copenhagen, and Pepe Escobar, you know, for the first time in honestly in a long time, Pepe wrote a great article that I almost fully 100% agreed with. For once, because he wasn't just going off on some rant about the Empire of Chaos. And I like Pepe, but he has a very anti-US bent that rubs me the wrong way, because it also gets in the way of good analysis that he's capable of doing. So here's an article it's literally the one that's on Zero Hedge today about what happened post, you know, with Prigozhin. And he made the point that what was happening while Prigozhin was going on his march to Moscow, and for the record, Pepe believes that this was all staged with CIA MI6 backing. Now, I'm not sure about that. I'm certainly willing to entertain it. Hell, I wrote a big article, you know, all but implicating them in this. But I'm also not convinced of any of that. But at the same time that was going on in Copenhagen, Victoria Nuland and Jake Sullivan had what Pepe called the swing states, the three weak links in the BRICS: India, South America.
Yeah.
Peel the BRICS off in Brazil, along with the swing states of Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and there's about seven of them. They were going in, and it was the EU. And this is where I give Escobar a lot of credit for not bringing the United States into this. You know, the meeting was called by the United States neocons, but it was actually being driven. But the policy of that meeting was being driven by the EU, who has now announced an 11th sanctions package. Now they were going to go after the third parties. If you don't go along with us, if you resell Russian oil, if you resell Russian goods, if you do this, if you do this, if you do that, we're sanctioning you as well. And they're trying to push they always do this. And this is how the European Union likes to act, you know. We're not telling you, you're not allowed to do this, but if you don't do this, then we're going to use our economic power to push you out of the global economy. Coercion, sanctions, this is their mechanism for all of this. It's, you will adopt our regulatory scheme or else. Now, the fun part about this is that this is the weak man at the table trying to set this agenda, right? But the EU still, for a short window of time, still has a tremendous amount of economic power to make that statement in market terms kind of money good. But it's only going to be money good for a short period of time, because the more you do this, as we found with Trump trying to take Iran and Venezuela and everybody else out of the global economy through shock and awe sanctions, guess what? They just reorient and reorganize around that. So now the question is Saudi, what they're hoping for is that Saudi Arabia and Turkey and all these swing states knuckle under and then isolate Russia further. This is going to be their last gasp of trying to keep this hegemonic sanctions package, this Western, and in this sense, it is actually the euro dollar system that they are trying to leverage here. So this is the big question. And this was all going on at the same time. So this is why Escobar is arguing that it was absolutely a setup, that Prigozhin's rebellion was bought and paid for by Western intelligence agencies in order for them to, at the same time, now put a new sanctions regime in place to try and escalate this war on the verge of the NATO summit that's coming in July, right? But again, look at who was pushing this. This is the European Union and the American crazy neocons, all the Ukrainian diaspora neocons, the Victoria Nulands, the Bob Kagans, you know, the Vindmans. They were all out there on Twitter that day in the Pippa Malgrims, all of them were out there embarrassing themselves as they drooled on their, you know, they were drooling on their Twitter feeds about how
really,
this was going.
It really did flush. It really did flush a lot of those
flush
people
out. It really did.
Unbelievable. Oh, we love the Wagner Group.
Yeah, all of a sudden we love the Wagner Group. 2 weeks ago they were terror. I mean, I found one tweet that was perfect. At 12 o'clock they were freedom fighters. By 1:30, after he had negotiated with Belarusian President Lukashenko to stand down, they were terrorists again. Like literally in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You know, same account.
Yeah.
Now calling them terrorists. Like you can't miss this if you're tuned into this stuff. Once you see the world this way, you can't unsee it, right? So all this speaks to, though, but look at what's happening. And again, this is all to get back to that argument that Biden is weaker, that cooler heads are prevailing. Because what did Biden do in the lead up to all of that? Why was this meeting even called in the first place? Why did this thing with Prigozhin even happen? If we accept the idea that Prigozhin was being manipulated or, you know, was being set up to do this thing to weaken Putin by Western intelligence agencies. Why? Because Biden explicitly blocked Ben Wallace, the UK defense secretary, from taking over for Jens Stoltenberg as general secretary of NATO. Now, this is the point I've been making for weeks now, which is that the Brits and the Poles and the Baltics are trying to push this forward. And Biden, up until that point, has been their guy to make all this happen. And then Biden all of a sudden is backing Stoltenberg, who's clearly stating we're not Ukraine still doesn't meet the targets, the requirements for accession into NATO and everything else. Well, Wallace was literally going around all of Europe for weeks trying to lobby everybody to lower the standard to allow Ukraine into NATO to then get an Article 5 invocation over the current conflict so that NATO could come in and we could start World War III. And they were going to do all this at the NATO summit. And Biden put the kibosh on that. Now, who is standing behind Biden that makes him change that policy? Well, there's two obvious choices. The people we've already identified, both the Chinese saying, look, this is not going any farther, or we expose you and you wind up in a prison cell. And now McCarthy's out there saying, I want to start impeachment proceedings with conviction at the same time of reversing the impeachment against Donald Trump.
I'm sorry.
Now, there's one
whatever,
more.
However it happened, what opportunity comes of it is like, okay, we can now, you know, threaten these things.
Yes. Yeah. And that's China on the one hand. And on the other hand is clearly the Pentagon doesn't want this. Clearly, Biden's been dragging his feet about because the Pentagon won't go along with this. So now you have the Pentagon who doesn't want to fight this war because they would be exposed because they don't want to be exposed to having to fight against the first world power because they understand where this goes. And so the Pentagon doesn't want it. The Chinese don't want it. And Biden had to back down. And so here's the worst part about this. The Brits and the Poles and the Baltics are trying to sign a treaty. Now, Alex Craner and I were on this the week after the Nord Stream pipeline bombing. We were talking about this in a podcast we did together where we were trying to figure out who was really behind it. And we came to the conclusion that it was the Brits and the Poles, if you guys remember. Why? Okay. Because Alex kept bringing up that the Brits were trying to get the Poles to sign a treaty with Ukraine that would make an end run around NATO and kind of backdoor NATO accession of Ukraine for Ukraine through a treaty with the Poles. So it's all tied together, guys. And now they're trying to continue to do the same end run. Why? Because NATO is under Stoltenberg and under the U.S. is saying, no, this is the limit. We can have a frozen conflict. We can negotiate some kind of peace settlement in some way, manner, shape, or form. But there are forces out there that refuse to give this up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's where we are right now. This is where we are.
I want to interject something or bring it back to the beginning. Okay. So you know the about the Wagner Rebellion, for lack of a better word, I have everything that TL is talking about completely makes sense. And obviously we're talking about conditional probabilities. It could be this, it could be that, but the path that he's mapping out makes sense. But the origin, whether it be, you know, Pepe Escobar's thing or not, I think is actually really, really simple. And it comes from, I forget his name, but a journalist who's actually, he's embedded in Ukraine. But it fit in with something that I had thought and made sense. The Wagner Rebellion, this is what I had read before the Wagner Rebellion. Russia, it's dangerous to have a mercantile, I'm sorry, I'm using that word again, merchant military on point for so long, referring to Wagner, right? The Hessians, so to speak, right? If you notice, and it's all that negotiation stuff, that geopolitical negotiation, we don't have enough bullets, we're not getting, you know, you get a little bit of public kvetching and complaining, and you have some tension between the Russian military, or Putin, I should say, and the Wagner group. Now, whether they're frenemies or working together, I don't care. But the bottom line is eventually Putin has to, in some way, shape, or form, fold them into more formally the Russian military. They're too important to be out there on their own. Okay, so.
Agreed.
Okay, good. So now this is where the plan hatches. Either it's Wagner hatching it or it's Putin and Wagner hatching it, but Wagner does, whether you think it's real or not, the rebellion, because it's not a coup, right? They go out there and basically, I'm going to put this in a worker management sort of situation. They're the employees and they go on strike. And they go on strike by going back to Russia, by Moscow, and saying, we're not going to fight anymore. You know, we think they're flexing. This is our power. This is what we have. And they draw a lot of attention, and which brings in all the neocons like, oh, we love the Wagner group. They're just like us, you know, all that shit. But what ends up happening is whether Putin was in on it or not, okay, it ends with, you know, a kind of War of the Roses thing, maybe using that analogy wrong, but it's like, you know, we're not going to shoot on Americans and on Russian troops. And what ends up happening is we're all Russian. You get flag waving, you get strengthening of Putin, and you get, and this is in the Wagner leadership's defense, you get the negotiation that they want, meaning we were going to be folded in as grunts. Now I'm going to get, you know, outsourced to whatever. I mean, maybe I won't die because I was too high profile, you know, whoever's running Wagner. Anyway, and the Erdogan parallel is where I got that from, as well as from the journalist. And the Erdogan parallels, although the coup there was real, he saw it for what it was. And after stopping it, he went through it methodically. It allowed him to remake the military that he wanted. And so folding in, getting rid of. So Wagner, the good Wagner people get folded in, the bad Wagner people get sent to Africa as
tough. Or they get pushed right to the Polish border in case the Poles get uppity. Because remember, Belarus is vulnerable. Okay. So, and Lukashenko is always vulnerable as well. Like it's right. it's they're the remnants of the 2020 coup attempt against Lukashenko are still viable. Like right. why would they have the that's why they officially you know declared the union state and all the rest of it. Like this is important. Like and you know that was funded by Merkel and the Germans and all of it. This was they were out there cheering, you know, the people in Minsk on to overthrow the evil Lukashenko because Lukashenko finally, you know, had to, you know, come to grips with the fact that Europe is not his friend. And you can't triangulate between Europe and Putin to get what you want. He was making the same mistake that Yanukovych tried to make for years when he was in charge over in Ukraine. And you know, eventually Europe and or the US, you know, take your, you know, they would eventually betray that guy because that's what they always do. And, you know, guys like Lukashenko and Yanukovych and whatnot have to, and, you know, same thing with Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan. They did this stuff for years. And Aliyev in Azerbaijan. I mean, this is like the history of the post-Soviet, you know,
right, all the Warsaw Pact countries.
That's not just the Warsaw Pact countries, but also the post the Soviet stands as well, in Central Union, Asia, right. and the mm-hmm. post-Soviet Union stands. Like this is how we've tried to triangulate them against Putin, and this has been going on, and it will continue to go on until it's no longer viable. Now here's the good news if you want geopolitical stability. Putin has figured all of this out. He has destroyed all of these. He's destroyed the ground game in all of these countries by he almost in some ways invites this stuff to happen so he can get these people to come out of the woodwork. And then he crushes them because he has successfully defended 6 out of the last 7 color revolution attempts against satellite countries. OK, the only one he failed in is Armenia, and even Pashinyan in Armenia is a very, very weak guy, okay? And he's only in power because no one else in Armenia is capable of taking power, but he doesn't really have much wiggle room.
Right, and if he was a port and had oil or something like that, it would be a higher priority, yeah.
Sure. Right, but I mean, ultimately, and now Erdogan, with his reelection, I think it shores up Turkey, right? And, you know, this is, again, all of these things have to happen. It's like certain things have to happen in dependencies, and there's all these things that have to happen in a particular order in order for a clear picture to emerge geopolitically. Okay. And I think that every moment like this has worked out, not perfectly, but for the most part has worked out to Putin's advantage in shoring up the soft underbelly of Russia, where it clearly has been under attack through multiple, on multiple fronts. All across Asia. The only place that they've in effect really failed at so far has been Pakistan, but they don't have nearly as much control over Pakistan. But with the Saudis, now this is why the Saudis are so important, because the Saudis have such immense influence within Pakistan. Okay. Because the Saudis have a tremendous amount of influence in the Pakistani military. I've talked to plenty of people about Pakistan, the situation in Pakistan. So clearly now we're trying to triangulate the Saudis against the Russians in the oil markets, bring it absolutely. All the way back to. So
that's the OPEC thing.
And that's clearly why the Biden administration has pushed to dump the SPR onto the market, tell the Saudis that if you don't watch yourself, we're going to, you know, take market share from you. We're going to crash the price of oil. We're going to, you know, destroy your budget and all the rest of it, all the things that you've been talking about, Vince. But I think the Saudis understand all this. And now the question now is how much longer, how the legs on this policy, you know, are they getting real short? I think they're getting real short because look, when you've got oil, you know, when you got domestic oil prices below $70 a barrel, like there ain't a whole lot of, and interest rates are 6%. You don't have a whole lot of wildcatters out there putting new wells in the ground. Like the rig count, as I was going over this the other day, the Baker Hughes rig count in the U.S. has dropped, 65, it's dropped over 10% from 627 rigs on, you know, drilling in December to 546 was the last number we got. And that rig count number is going to drop. And I think we're going to see a crest in American oil production over the course of the next 3 to 4 months. And then it's going to start to fall off again. And once that, because the cure for high oil prices is high oil prices. The cure for low oil prices is low oil prices. So, you know, and this is where Powell's, you know, insistence on pushing credit capital costs up plays into breaking this this insane mercantilist thing. And as well, also pay the Chinese and everybody else for holding on to U.S. debt and to still want to recycle some U.S. debt. Because remember, in the last couple of months, the TIC reports stabilized. The Japanese aren't dumping. The Chinese haven't dumped in the last couple of months. So the only buyer of U.S. treasuries at central bank level have been everything attached to the Eurozone.
So I have a question for... I mean, I'm not the interviewer here, but I have a question because I really want your opinions on this. Everything that you got, everything that's being said, let's assume that the U.S. tactically has everything where they want it. Just for this part of the conversation, we've got oil at a price that we're comfortable with. We're in the process of negotiating. We've sort of neutralized the animosity with OPEC. We're beginning to peel back the bricks. I view it as, and this is where I don't know what the answer is. I have an opinion, but I'm not sure yet. It seems to me that given the situation that I just described, and you have a West that's trying to impede Eastern progress with a focus on Russia by, for example, getting the price of oil low and stable to cut off their revenues. Mm-hmm. And you have an East that's trying to impede the West by withdrawing from the financial infrastructure that we've created. All right. So here's the question. If we are in, let's say, a more or less optimal situation from our perspective financially, meaning we can't make it much better. We can't get oil much lower. The Baker Hughes rig count is going to start factoring in. We're running into peak production, whether you believe that or not. Well, let's assume that we can't do that forever. Do you think time is on our side or on Russia's side? And I want to make this very clear. I'm representing the neocons. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm representing the Davos neocon types. Right. I believe, and when I say this, I believe that in the marathon, Russia collapses because they're just a warlord country that makes their money off of oil revenues. And if we cut off their oil revenues and peel the other bricks back, over the long run, everyone will walk away from Russia except China, and China will be forced to either turn their back on them, you know, metaphorically, or negotiate for peace. Now, speaking from the Russian point of view, the U.S. standard of living and desire and need for standard of living, right, is deteriorating. And because it's a democratically elected government, they will fold to short-term pressures, and the U.S., the West, will not be able to, in the long run, hold its position. So that's, in my mind, I think Putin, representing Russia, and let's say neocon Davos, representing the West, both think they win in the long run. And that's my question to both of you.
Clearly. Clearly, that's the strategy. Listen to that's clearly what they both think.
And Ukraine is going to get destroyed in the meantime. You know, that's how.
And Ukraine is the fulcrum. Like, I get it. And I clearly, and you're absolutely right, Vince. That's the way both sides are thinking.
But now, it's a genuine question. So
it is.
So if nothing else changes from here, you know, now we're getting into like I like to talk pie in the sky, but now we're getting into quantification. How much more can we draw down the SPR? How quickly can we get nuclear reactors up? You know, how quickly can China get its thorium stuff going? How quickly can you marshal sentiment to cut back? You know, how bad does the weather have to get? You know, and the reason I asked that question in earnest is because whether I agree or not, the Wagner thing shows the potential for risk of underbelly. I think is the phrase that Tom used for Putin's control. And, you know, it didn't expose it. It tried to expose it. But there's all these little tests, whether it be MI6 or Davos or neocons or all three of them, you know, or whether it be, you know, the Saudis going, fuck, we're not making any money. Oil's trading $60 a barrel, you know, because the Saudis are really the mafia. That's how they operate. You know, so we want to get some new jets from the U.S. We'll pump a little more oil. Fuck you, Russia. You know, we'll move on from there. But you know, they're just playing both sides against the middle. What I'm getting at is, China and the U.S. may be negotiating. The BRICS and the G7 may be negotiating, but it seems like it's like Russia and the neocon faction of the West both believe in the long run they win. Yep. And
yeah, no, that's why this conflict is not going to end anytime soon.
Right.
But here's the game. I'm going to just make the argument that I think the Russians have the upper hand here, because I think that they have made the point clearly. And every time the U.S. look, the neocons have one tool. Europe has one tool, and that is mercantilism. That means high protection tariffs.
Right.
But they need a strong currency in Europe in order to deal with the oil
price. And they can't get a strong currency because they don't have fiscal unity. But that's right.
And it's a very important, but it's a very important point. They need this because they're a net energy importer. They need the euro to stay stronger than it actually is. It is. And that's why this euro at $1.09, and we're doing this on the Q2 close. This is June 30th. We're doing this, right? And I was watching the markets this morning. I was just like, okay, Lagarde, how much more are you going to sit on the German 10-year? How much more are you going to, you know, how can you stretch these markets this far? Why is Lagarde now talking about, well, we're moving full force towards a digital Europe? Why is Germany all of a sudden now talking about reparations for Poland, right? Like, why are these things happening? They don't have any money. Well, no, they know. It's a very interesting question. But I think that the Russians can continue to pump. They're making money. Most of the members of OPEC are making money. The Saudis are the ones that are stuck needing $80 a barrel oil as long as they keep the real pegged to the dollar. The minute that they decide to loosen the peg versus the dollar and start doing business outside of the dollar, they don't need $80 a barrel. Their production costs are not $80 a barrel. Their budget needs are $80 a barrel. And their budget needs are that level because it's in terms of dollars. You depeg the real. And I urged MBS to depeg when oil was above $100 a barrel. He didn't listen to me.
Did he take your call?
No, I never got that call. And so, but I've been saying for a long time now, like, and I think that the gig here is, if you see oil push back towards $85 a barrel Brent,
totally.
Then they start to do the thing, and they start to loosen the peg, and because now they can play the game of bringing it down. They can start to, they're not running a budget deficit, and they can start to de-dollarize the oil trade. Totally. And I think that is what's in their back pocket, and that's why Nuland and Sullivan and the European Union were so adamant about their goal with Prigozhin's thing. This is in effect Escobar's thesis. And I'm not saying I disagree with Pepe, but I'm throwing it out there because he's the one who's put it in these terms. I didn't even put it in these terms, so that's why I'm invoking Pepe here. Is that we have exposed Putin as weak. We have set the process in motion to balkanize the Russians. Oh, by the way, and you know that was the arm twist that was going on in Copenhagen while Prigozhin's little thing was going on. And it's also why they're also goddamned angry this morning, because they didn't get what they want. They didn't get what they wanted, which was they didn't get a weakening of Putin. They got a strengthening of Putin. Okay. Yes, they got a weakening of the Wagner Group, right? And maybe that's enough.
Oh yeah,
and maybe that's a win, and maybe that's the only win they get, but they don't get enough because, like, there's so this is the gig, and they're crying in their beer this morning, and this is why we start to see the things that you and I were talking about on Twitter before we got on this call. The Russians announced yesterday that they're doing a gold settled futures contract and with lots of small as a gram of gold. Like, this is a big deal. Now the Russians are now putting in place, and they've made all the same moves now in 2023 that the Chinese made in 2014, 2015, when they were putting the Xifei oil contract together.
That's right.
Which is tied to anybody who wants to trade oil in Russia will be able to get their money out, because they'll be able to convert their profit. And if they don't want to take on the FX risk of owning rubles, they can lay off their FX risk by going into the gold settled futures market in Moscow, in order to lay off their FX risk for doing business in oil in Russia, which is exactly the way it works in China. It's a little bit more complicated in China. You have the offshore yuan futures settlement for gold, which can be tied to Xifei, right? To the Xifei oil contract. And remember also, by the way, according to him, Martin Armstrong is the one that advised the Chinese to do exactly this 10 years ago. He was the one who said you need to tie this contract in some way to gold, so that people can be comfortable with doing business there by knowing that if worst comes to worst, they can always get their money out in gold. They can always get their profit out through the gold market. So the Russians are just setting up the same exact infrastructure within Moscow. And oh, by the way, the same thing is happening in Dubai with the Dubai gold contract and the Dubai oil contract. And the more that we manipulate and volatility wash people out of their positions in Brent in New York, the more the exchange volume is going to shift from west to east to these other places where the markets aren't nearly as manipulated. And so
Right. That's
why Putin thinks he can outlast them. And at the end of the day, I think MBS, I've been writing about this a lot, not publicly, but I did a writing about this for Newsmax and all of my Newsmax stuff in the last couple of months, and where I really did a lot of thinking about this. And I said, look, I'm thinking to myself, MBS, I was tracing the history of MBS's coming to power in Saudi Arabia, and it's very clear that we don't have a ground game there anymore either. Because, you know, Nayef was the CIA's guy, and MBS is nobody's guy. And then after he comes to power and does the whole Hotel Palace coup thing, the very Sopranos thing that he did, well, guess what? Then the L'Affaire Khashoggi and tying it to Erdogan and all of this stuff. It's all tied to this, of us trying to get back control of the Saudi royal house, and it failed. And MBS knows exactly what's going on here. So he's another one they took a shot at the king and failed in Saudi Arabia. They took a shot at the king and failed, multiple shots at the king and failed in Turkey. Now they've taken a shot at Lukashenko in Belarus and failed. Tokayev in Kazakhstan, fail, blah, blah. I can go down the list. And none of these people are going back onto the reservation because they understand what the game is. And all we can really do here is continue to play the same game as those weapons become less and less and less powerful. Because when you go to nuclear weapons, in case of financial nuclear weapons, cutting people out of SWIFT, all this happy, you know, the seizing foreign exchange reserves and all the rest of it. If you don't win on that, you lose that as a weapon in your arsenal. And those weapons are all gone. Those weapons are all gone now. They're all off the table as far as they've all been proven to be less powerful than people thought they were. And every day, the world moves away from SWIFT.
The parent that slaps their child loses the ability to slap their child in the future.
Bingo.
Thanks for joining us for part one of this conversation. Join us for part two with Tom, Vince, and I, where we discuss gold convertibility, BRICS Plus changes, gold bookkeeping, digital euro and FedNow, and the end of LIBOR. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.